is the Internet with the Oral History Series sponsored by the Decatur Public Library. Our guest today is Mr. Anthony J. Perry. He served the Decatur Memorial Hospital from his arrival at Decatur in 1951. Mr. Perry, what jobs did you hold at the hospital?
Originally, I came as a student. I was an administrative resident from 1951 to 1952, which was a period of time that I had to serve to qualify me for a master's degree in hospital administration from Northwestern University. Upon completion of my degree requirements, I was appointed assistant administrator in 1952, and then later became the associate administrator in 1958. And in 1961, I succeeded Leon C. Pullen, Jr., who was the then administrator, as administrator. I served as administrator from 1961 to 1969, and my title was changed to Executive Vice President in 1969 and to President and Chief Executive Officer in 1974. I retired from the hospital in 1986 after 35 years of service with the hospital. As you may know, when I came, the hospital was called the Decatur and Macon County Hospital, and its name was changed to Decatur Memorial Hospital later.
Well, those are impressive jobs. I might say that I have just been rereading the history of Decatur Memorial Hospital in the book, The Vigil Never Ceases, 2 miles north. And in this book, your work with the hospital is given very high praise. You're described as one of the most vital forces since the adventurous days of Dr. Will Barnes. Well, now, we want to know more about your career, of course, but first, let's hear about your early life, where you were born, where you grew up, and so forth. Will you tell us something about that?
I'd be happy to. I was the youngest of a family of five, born in a New England truck farm, of immigrant parents. And I was the only member of the family who was privileged to go to college, went on to obtain a bachelor's degree in education. And from then, I went into the military and went to New York University for a year studying meteorology. And I was a weather forecaster in World War II for almost 3 years. I was discharged from the military in Europe and went to work for TWA International, which was just starting its overseas roots, and worked for TWA International for about 14 months in Lisbon, Portugal, where I had been previously based with the military. Interesting enough, Portugal was a neutral country, so for the last year that I was in the military, I was in civilian clothes, and I was a government official in Lisbon, Portugal. I then decided that I'd lived in Europe long enough, so I came back to the United States, being still single, I decided that I was getting to the age where I should be considering a family, and I went to work for Peruvian International Airways in New York City at LaGuardia Airport, and had the privilege of running the first scheduled passenger carrying flight out of JFK Airport in New York, which was then called Idlewild. Our airline was the first airline to be moved over to JFK. And I met my wife at JFK, and she was working for KLM, the Royal Dutch Airline. From there, I worked for a brief time with Pan American Airways in New York, and then decided that I would go back to school and enrolled at Northwestern University and had to take some prerequisites. finished my master's degree in hospital administration at Northwestern University in 1952.
What caused you to choose hospital administration as your career?
Well, it's
after your experience with the aviation?
I was very fascinated with aviation. I loved aviation and I flew myself, but my future was uncertain because I had been employed overseas. And I didn't know how long I was going to have to work overseas with TWA. And so when I came back to the United States, it was pretty much with the idea that I would look for another career. The airline industry was in some disarray at that time. It was growing rapidly, but in a very disorganized manner. I had a man who was very, very influential in my life, And he kept reappearing at critical points in my life. I first ran into him when I was in high school. He was the superintendent of schools when I was in high school. His name was Norman Bailey, and my sister was his secretary for 12 years. And he encouraged many of the young country boys to go on and get an education. He encouraged me to go to college, and I did. And when I came out of college, I was successful in getting a commission in the military. And when I came back to New York, he was running a hospital in New York City. He'd gotten out of school administration into hospital administration and was teaching at Columbia University, School and Hospital Administration. And about the time that I made my decision, he decided to come back to Chicago, where he'd been originally, and had been on the faculty of Northwestern University. So I quit my job in New York, got married, moved to Chicago, enrolled in Northwestern, and spent my academic year on campus in Northwestern. When I was ready for my residency, which I had to serve to qualify for my degree, I had to find an acceptable preceptor. Well, it so happens that I had worked at Michael Reese Hospital when I was going to Northwestern, and Leon Pullen, who was the administrator here at the time, had worked at Michael Reese Hospital in Chicago while he was going to Northwestern, because it was an evening program. And so Norm Bailey said that Leon Pullen was looking for somebody to help him in Decatur. So as a result of a mutual friendship, I came to Decatur to spend my 1 year with Leon Pullen. And at the end of the year, the hospital decided they would offer me an administrative position here at Decatur and Macon County Hospital. And that's how I ended up in Decatur. And it's interesting, Leon Pullen and his wife Nancy became very close friends of ours. He was from Portland, Maine, and we were both New Englanders, and we got along very well.
Well, very good. It's amazing how all the parts of your life seem to fit together like puzzles, and you, all these different people seem to get together and decide, help you decide your future.
I can't say that I ever had a master plan. I always felt that if I did a good job at whatever I was doing, that something good would happen. And that's the way it seemed to have happened.
So in a way, Decatur is the benefactor of your experience, even though you didn't choose it exactly. But you did finally, of course, find yourself in Decatur. What was the situation you found when you arrived here?
Well, it was what I refer to as a golden opportunity. The hospital, of course, had been through the Depression, World War II, and was getting into the Korean War situation. And almost anything that you did was a help. It needed many, many things, including good organization. It needed to develop its employees. It had not had any professional management for some time. And Leon Pullen came a year before I did and was the first professionally trained hospital administrator that the hospital had had. Not that they didn't have some good people running the hospital before, because back in the late 20s and 30s, it had excellent administration under the supervision of a physician. But the result of the wars and the Depression, it was badly in need of many, many things. And of course, after World War II, healthcare just exploded in technology and many of the things that were learned during World War II.
So you were the right person in the right place at the right time.
Well,
you've told us about the great help and influence of Mr. Pullen, but there probably were others who influenced you at Decatur Memorial Hospital.
Yes, there were many, many people, too many to really mention. But among them were the chairman of the board of directors. I believe that during my experience here in Decatur that I worked under 13 different chairmen of the board, and they were all top executives in the community, and I feel that they did a lot to further my skills, executive skills. Also, I had the pleasure of working with several outstanding physicians and developed a very close understanding of medicine as it's as practiced in a community like ours. We also had a great group of employees, which were very helpful and very loyal, because you can't be a leader unless you have a following.
Right. You mentioned some of the great, you might say, explosions following World War II. There were many events that occurred at that time, and among them was the advent of Medicare. That certainly must have had an influence on the hospital.
Yes, it had a profound influence on the hospital, and of course, not only did we have Medicare, but we had accelerating inflation, we had accelerating cost of care, and increased cost of the new technology. So there were profound changes in the way the hospital was paid for the care of the elderly, as an example. Prior to Medicare, we relied upon the resources of retired people to pay their own hospital bills. After Medicare, even though it may not have paid as much as the healthcare industry felt that it should, it was certainly more than what was being paid in the earlier years when we had to rely on the resources. The community, however, in the hospital was very well endowed, and that was very, very helpful in providing care. Also, it was a very profound way in the way that people were treated. I can remember when we had two 10-bed wards that were full of patients that were really there until they died.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, in today's world, those people are not in the hospital. They are in nursing homes and other healthcare facilities.
There were other certain physical needs for building and maintenance that you had to take care of too, weren't there?
Yes, the hospital was what I refer to as a tuberculosis sanatorium mm-hmm. configuration.
Mm-hmm.
It was spread out, that was fine when it was originally designed. There was no air conditioning, there were no toilet facilities in most of the patients' rooms. The traffic patterns within the institution were difficult for visitors, it was difficult for personnel, new personnel. So we had to cope with all of those things. And I can remember when we put in our first window air conditioning unit, and we put colored lines on the floors to get people to go, direct people from one location to another. And then, of course, we had to begin to vertically integrate the institution and start to go up with it, because vertical transportation on elevators is much more efficient than horizontal transportation on wheeled vehicles. And so we had to cope with all those changes, plus the fact that we had to institute a lot of programs. We had no pension program for our employees. We had employees that had worked there for 35 years that had no, weren't even covered by Social Security. Mm-hmm. So those social changes were coming along, and we had to be able to retire some of those people with dignity. And so we joined the Social Security program, we put in the pension program, we started a training program to develop new employees, we had to train people in the new technology, we had to train maintenance people to maintain air conditioning systems and all the electronics that were coming down the road.
And there was a great advance in the treatment of certain diseases, such as the use of radiation and other ways of treating diseases.
That's true. But surprisingly enough, back in the early days of the hospital was very, very advanced. Dr. Barnes, as you may have read, was a real progressive thinking man. And we actually had radiation therapy equipment here back before the Depression. He was insistent that we be right up to date, and we had a huge radiation therapy machine that was back where the offices eventually ended up in the old main building. We had one of the first laminographs west of the Appalachian Mountains. It was one of the first hospitals in the country to be licensed to use insulin. So it had a big spurt of technology before the Depression, and then everything sort of collapsed during the Depression, and then it all got started up after World War II, and we started using some of the new technology and the new radiographic equipment and therapy equipment. And then it wasn't until 1968 that we put in the present day type of radiation therapy equipment to treat cancer.
And now Decatur Memorial is one of the outstanding units in the treatment of cancer, isn't it?
Yes, they have a cancer care center. We've added not only the X-ray treatment or the radiation therapy treatment and linear accelerators and all that, we've also added chemotherapy, which is treating cancer medically with drugs.
You mentioned something about the organization of the staff and so on, but I read about the Graduate Directors Council. What was that?
Well, this was an interesting development because when I came here and when Mr. Pullen was here, we came and the board of directors was composed of people who had been on the board for many, many years. Many of them were getting up in the years and they really didn't want to serve on the board any longer, but there was no mechanism for rotating board members at that time. And so it was Mr. Staley's idea, J.E. Staley Jr., that there ought to be some way of rotating people off the board and yet not lose their talent and their support, because these people have been very loyal supporters, not only organizationally but financially. And so he suggested that we create a Graduate Directors Council, and if anyone had served on the board of directors for 9 years, then they were eligible to be appointed to the Graduate Directors Council, and it served as an advisory board and still serves today as an advisory group to the board of directors and the management of the hospital.
And it works?
It works very, very well. Unfortunately, many of the graduate directors that were here when I came and during my early years have passed on, but a new core of graduate directors is being produced because now the maximum term on the board of directors is 9 years.
And you can make use of that experience that has been built up. And
yes. They were invaluable. We had people who were on the board like A.E. Staley Jr., John Wagner, Ira Abbott, Mr. Scheider from the Staley Company, Bill Barnes, Mr. Van Law, and a lot of those people who were shakers and movers, so to speak, and who made things happen. And they were men who could make a decision sitting at the table and didn't have to go back and consult with anybody to do it.
Well, good. Now, there were outside factors putting pressure on the hospital, too. We read about it in the papers every day. Malpractice suits, the insurance costs, and so on. Does that cause you any problem?
Well, as you know, whenever there is a pot of gold, there's an attempt to for people to try to get some of it. Prior to the middle 50s, hospitals had what they call charitable immunity. A hospital could not be sued for malpractice because it was a charitable organization. But once hospitals became more affluent and had more funds, then we gradually lost that immunity from suit. And of course, after that, then we had to buy insurance. And once you start buying insurance, then people are more inclined to sue or at least file claims, and it just sort of develops. It's the same way with the federal government. Prior to the implementation of Medicare, we were only answerable to the state of Illinois and to the city of Decatur as far as building codes were concerned. Once we started accepting federal funds for construction as well as for Medicare, then we came under the guidelines of the Medicare legislation and we had to conform to federal standards. And that's how we got into difficulty with the life safety codes. As an example, we built the Staley Pavilion. It was opened in 1968 and 69. And it was built according to the specifications of the codes that were in force at the time the building was designed in 1965-66. The federal government modified its life safety codes, and then we had to bring the building into some semblance of compliance. Here it was a brand new building, practically, and yet it was out of compliance with life safety codes because of federal legislation and federal changes.
This changing the rules in the middle of the game.
Yes, it was changing the rules, and interesting, there were many ramifications of it, and eventually we negotiated it out to where the cost was high but not prohibitive. At one point in time, it was felt that in order to comply with the life safety codes, that we were going to have to practically gut the interior of the building and rebuild it. But fortunately, the federal government realized that the costs were going to be excessive when you looked at all the hospitals in the country that were built at that time or earlier, and they then came up with a different system for coming up with an equivalency of the code. And that's what we ended up doing in conjunction with a building program in the middle 70s.
Now, it's no secret that you had opportunities to go elsewhere probably about this time. I know that you were offered other positions and other opportunities. One is the Hospital Research and Development Institute at Pensacola, Florida. You were invited to join this group. What is that, and what were your feelings about all this? Was it just the attraction of Decatur, or what was your attraction here?
Well, it was a combination of things. There was a lot of growth opportunity here, and managers like growth, and they like to manage growth. We like to build things. We like to see an organization grow. And all during the 60s, we were in that growth mode, and it was interesting. I'll tell you an interesting side story to that. About a year or two, it was later than that. It was in the middle 60s. And we had a significant building program on the drawing board, and I received a telephone call one day from a recruitment firm, and they wanted to know if I was interested in a job in the Midwest in a bigger hospital, probably at more money. And I said, no, I'm really not interested. So they've been treating me well here. I've only been on this job as the administrator for a short period of time. We've got a big building program going, and I feel a commitment to the community. So to make a long story short, they said, well, why don't you come to Cleveland, Ohio for an interview? We'd just like to have your curriculum vitae in our file so that in case something comes up later on, you'd be interested in. So I didn't want to hurt the feelings. I didn't want to burn my bridges. And so I went to Cleveland, Ohio and got into the airport and stayed at the motel. And next morning, they picked me up and we were obviously driving out of town instead of in town. And I said, you know, where are we going? He said, oh, we're going to Canton, Ohio.
Oh, it wasn't Cleveland.
And I said, Canton, Ohio? I said, I thought I told you that I was not interested in moving. To make a long story short, they took me to a hospital in Canton, Ohio that was looking for an administrator. They wined and dined me, and I kept saying, but I don't want to move. I'm not looking for a job. And before I left that day, they offered me the job. And I came back to Decatur and didn't even consider it because, again, I felt I had a commitment here. They were treating me fairly, and they were treating me well. And so I decided I would stay in Decatur. And then, of course, as you grow older, then your opportunities to move lessen. The Hospital Research and Development Institute group is an interesting group, and their real reason for existence was to create a forum where an orderly system for the exchange of information and advice between practicing hospital administrators and the decision makers in the health-related industries could take place. In other words, it's a think tank group.
Sounds good.
There were 25 of us, and we had about, at that time, 35 clients. Some of the giants in the healthcare industry that were providing services to the healthcare industry, such as the American Hospital Supply Corporation, such as Eli Lilly Company. We had one, not more than two, of any one industry. The Hill-Rom Company, which is a big manufacturer of hospital patient room furniture. And the idea was that they would test their ideas on us, what we thought was going to be helpful in the marketplace. And then we were on the cutting edge of what was being developed by those industries who were the leaders in the hospital, in the healthcare field. So it was a two-way street, an exchange of ideas, but it always benefited the hospital and benefited us professionally because we knew what these companies had on the drawing boards. And many times we were able to participate in the early trials and the early experimentation with some of these devices. One of them I had a very important role in this. Back in the those days, we had a lot of problem with patients falling out of bed. And in most cases, patients went up over the top of the side rails rather than getting out of bed voluntarily. And so it was felt that if they developed what they call a safety side, which was a half a bed rail, that it would not preclude the patient who was determined to get out of bed, but it would keep the patient from inadvertently rolling out of bed. And as a result, it cut falls from bed significantly. That was one of them. The other one that we pioneered was the intravenous stand. They used to be on casters, and the nurses were always looking for one. And I said to them, why don't we just put this under the bed? And so we developed a telescoping intravenous stand that fit in a little trough underneath the bed. Every bed had one. And wherever,
so you didn't have to move them around.
Wherever the bed went, the intravenous stand. And then there was a couple of holes in the spring where you could just put the pole in and go on. So it was fun to be involved in some of the very simple but very important
and
things.
Helpful.
We had one of the first voice-actuated nurse call systems, where the patient could talk to the nurse, and the nurse could talk to the patient without having to press buttons to talk and listen. So there were a lot of things like that. And this organization was also the think tank for several other related organizations that I was part of founding. One was Voluntary Hospitals of America, which was started with 30 leading hospitals in the country to put together a shared service organization that would bring advantages to each of the member hospitals. And that organization now has almost 100 hospital shareholders in it and about 700 related hospitals. And it did everything from purchasing to managing nursing homes and health maintenance organizations, et cetera, and still exists today. It's now about 10, 11 years old. Mm-hmm. Another company that was started, which I was involved in, was an offshore insurance company. During the malpractice crisis of 1975, a group of hospital administrator friends of mine went down to Bermuda and got a charter to start an insurance company in Bermuda, and then another one in Grand Cayman. And 2 years later, our hospital came into it, and I was on the board of directors of that company and the one in Grand Cayman, which insured doctors. And that was the only way we could make malpractice insurance available to hospitals and doctors in some parts of the country. That company today has transformed into a U.S.-based stock company that I'm the chairman of the board of that company, which is now called MMI Companies. And last year, our gross written premiums was over $100 million. We have 165 employees, and it's based in Chicago, Illinois, and we've got a subsidiary in London, a subsidiary in Grand Cayman. We got a subsidiary in Kansas City. We have a life insurance company in Kansas City. So it's developed from a small start to a significant organization.
Now, this Hospital Research and Development Institute then wasn't a full-time job, but you just did that part-time, so-called leisure.
It required very little of our time. And the philosophy was that it should not interfere with your work. It's something you should do after hours and your days off, vacations and things like that. So it was not a very intense type of thing. There were no written reports, and there was nothing that was very, very time consuming. But a couple of times a year, we did sit down with clients at a educational session and swap ideas.
It sounds like an ideal organization. Moving on, we've had a good deal of discussion of nurses training at Decatur Memorial Hospital and other places. Can you give us a little survey of the way that nurses training has developed in Decatur?
Well, actually, the School of Nursing started almost before the hospital was open. They took the first class in 1915, and the hospital opened on January 1 of 1916.
Well, they needed the nurses before they could have a hospital.
That was the reason. They needed nurses, and they realized that they had to train a local supply. So the school was founded, and interestingly enough, it was founded by Dr. Barnes, who was the prime mover, but the first director of the school was from Massachusetts, from Boston, Massachusetts. And of course, Dr. Barnes had been trained in Massachusetts, and so he had contacts, and he brought this woman to run the School of Nursing. And it was a very fine school. It was closed for a short period of time during the Depression, then reopened, and then ran continuously until Millikan University started a program, a Bachelor of Science degree program in nursing, close to 10 years ago. And at that time, then we phased out our school at the hospital. In some respects, it's too bad that we did, because the baccalaureate schools are not turning out enough nurses to really meet the supply. The cost of a Bachelor of Science degree in nursing is much more than the traditional two-year nurse program at the hospitals, because the hospital subsidized it. But there was a lot of pressure from the nursing organizations to make nursing a profession, and they felt that any nurse that did not have a degree was not truly a professional. To fill some of that void, a school for practical nurses, a licensed practical nurses, was started by the Decatur School District and is still operated today. So the two primary sources of nursing personnel in Decatur now are the Millikan University School of Nursing and the Licensed Practical Nurse School. Now, there are some other schools in surrounding cities, but our primary source is from those two.
Well, the hospital also supplies home care too, doesn't it?
Yes, in the late 70s and early 80s, there was a significant trend toward keeping people out of the hospital and keeping them in the home or in some other institution. It started by taking patients out of the hospital and putting them in nursing homes. And then they found that the nursing homes were not the best solution to that problem. So then they got into the Visiting Nurse Association and started to provide some home health care. But that didn't accelerate fast enough. And then in recent years, and again as a result of Medicare programs, there's been a proliferation of home health care. And before I left the hospital, we started a home health care program, which is doing very, very well. And it's a follow-up and meeting the needs of patients. And this way you can get patients out of the hospital faster, because the hospital is the most expensive form of care in the healthcare system. Home health care is not only less expensive, but it keeps the patient in their own home environment. Many times they do better, especially older people who might become disoriented in an environment that they're not familiar with, and so it's proliferated, and it's a good thing. Mm-hmm. There's been many other things that the hospitals have diversified into, also durable medical equipment, which is canes and crutches and wheelchairs, and all those things that a patient needs at home.
Well, we certainly know the part that nurses play in healthcare, but it does seem as if, from what we read in the papers and hear about, that there must be a shortage of nurses. Is that true?
Yes, there is a growing shortage, and many people in the field feel that it's going to become critical in the very near future. The root cause of some of the problem is that prior to you might say the liberation of women, most young women went into teaching or nursing or got married and raised a family. With the changes in the educational system and more opportunities for women, women are now lawyers and doctors and engineers and pilots and everything else, and so it's taking all those, that pool of people, and diverting them away from some of the traditional careers in the healthcare field. We've always had some men in nursing, but they've been the minority, and they still are the minority. But now the schools are unable to attract as many nurses as they had been prior to that change in our social structure, and it's going to create a severe problem. The other problem is we still haven't faced up to the recognition of the value of the nurse. They're a little bit comparable to a school teacher, except that the school teachers in some respects have easier environments to work in unless you're in a big city, where nurses work 24 hours a day, 7 days
hard
a week.
Work.
It's hard work. It's highly technical. It's very intense. Many of them suffer burnout that are working in intensive care units because really there's nothing left in the hospital except intense care of patients that are critically ill. And that puts an additional pressure on the nurse. So the healthcare field is going to have to come up with some way of solving that problem. I suppose part of the solution is going to be better compensation, better recognition of the value of the nurse, mm-hmm. which can lead toward increased costs.
Right. But if it brings more nurses into the system, it would be worth it.
Well, we have to solve the problem, and there has mm-hmm. to be some magnet that attracts people to any profession, whether it's medicine or whether it's airline pilots mm-hmm. or whether it's engineers or teachers. Mm-hmm. People are not going to choose a less rewarding profession if they have a choice of a more rewarding one, both financially and professionally.
Well, now, there's another group of people that we haven't acknowledged yet. That is the volunteer. You rely very strongly on volunteers in your hospital work, don't you?
Oh, yes. Volunteers are a very, very important part of the healthcare scene, not only in the hospital, but even in home healthcare and some of those programs. Of course, a lot of people think that volunteerism started in the World War II, but actually there were volunteers in our healthcare institutions going back from their inception.
Florence Nightingale,
although she was not a volunteer, she was very close to one. But in the after World War II, there was a big resurgence of volunteer groups. And the resurgence hit Decatur, Macon County Hospital, with the founding of the so-called Women's Auxiliary in 1954, which was a reincarnation of some of the guilds that had existed in previous years. And of course, there were two people who were very, very important in that movement. One was Mrs. Carl Dick Sr., who was a fabulous woman and was the person who brought the idea to Decatur. And then, of course, there was Fanny Bassett, who recently passed away, Mrs. Fraser Bassett, who was the first president of the auxiliary, and they really got it off to a great start. And they're very important in many ways. They have many excellent service projects. They're excellent in explaining the hospital to the community and community relations. They're good in fundraising, both direct and indirect. And when I say that, I mean, you know, they raise funds through fun fair and through gift shops and thrift shops. But in addition to that, there are a lot of women and men now in the auxiliary who explain the hospital story to people in the community who have wealth to leave to someone. There are many people who have substantial wealth who have no heirs to leave it to. And I always say they either had to leave it to the church, to the university, to the hospital. Mm-hmm. Through good relations, and many of those people belong to the auxiliary, the hospital was the benefactor of many very fine bequests over the years. And of course, men came into the auxiliary and they changed the name from the Women's Auxiliary to the DMH Auxiliary mm-hmm. back in the 60s. And we have a lot of men who volunteer and who do a good job. We used to refer to the auxiliary as the hospital's annuity, and that they were a valuable resource that kept producing benefits mm-hmm. year in and year out, just like a fine annuity would.
Well, what do you see for the future of the Decatur Memorial Hospital?
Well, Decatur Memorial Hospital is like many other hospitals in the country, in that it's suffering from major changes in the delivery of health care. As I said before, there's been a lot of emphasis on getting the patient out of the hospital sooner, keeping the patient from going to the hospital unless he or she has to, and that's had a marked effect on the capacity or the utilization of hospitals as well as the financial side of the hospital. The healthcare industry is a $500 billion a year industry. It's huge, it's growing at a rate which is comparable to the gross national product, but it's being spent in very, very different ways. We now have surgery centers and urgent centers. A lot of things are being done in doctor's offices. A lot of things are being done on an outpatient basis instead of inpatient basis, in clinics. We have better highways now. People can get to tertiary care centers. And as new technology and new techniques develop, as an example, bypass surgery for heart problems. We do not do that in Decatur. It's being done in Springfield. A lot of those patients, before they had that type of surgery in Springfield, stayed in Decatur. They were in the cardiac care unit. They were treated medically. They were kept in bed until they got better and didn't go out of town. Now, if a patient is suspected of having a heart attack or having some problems with the circulation in his lung, in his heart, he's packed up and shipped to Springfield or somewhere else. So that's just an example of some of the major changes. And Decatur is going to have to find its own niche, such as in cancer care, in order to maintain its viability in the future. The hospital now has, on average, more than 100 patients per day less than it had in the late 60s and early 70s. Fortunately, it's caring for many of those patients on an outpatient basis. But as an example, I can remember if you had cataracts, you came into the hospital. We operated on them manually. They put the patient in bed with sandbags on both sides of their head and kept them immobile for the better part of 2 weeks. Now they walk in the morning. They take off the cataract with a laser beam. They walk out that same day. So you can imagine what that does to hospital utilization. The same way with a hernia operation. I had a hernia repaired in 1965. I stayed in the hospital 5 days. Why did I stay for 5 days? Because stitches came out at the end of the fifth day. Now the patient can come in, be operated on, go home the next day or the same day in some cases. Maternity is the same way. Mothers used to stay in the hospital 10 to 14 days. Now, in many areas of the country, they come in, deliver, and go home. Mm-hmm. Indicator's not quite at that level yet, but it's down to 3 days. Mm-hmm. So these are all affecting. Another big effect on the future of our hospital is the aging population. That by the year 2000, 60% of all inpatients will be attributed to the over age 65 group. I'd like to go back and review some factors that will influence Decatur Memorial Hospital, along with other hospitals in the country. That is from a report by McManus Associates, which was recently presented to the board of directors of our insurance company, which outlines some of the major healthcare trends. McManus Associates is a consulting firm in Washington, D.C., and are considered to be one of the leaders. Some of their predictions are that there will be continued cost containment pressures. The soaring cost of health care and the staggering national debt have forced the federal government to curtail its support of the national health care system. Despite the fact that the United States spends more per capita, which is approximately $2,000 for health care, than any other nation, U.S. health statistics are among the worst of the industrialized nation. And there's also the pressure from corporate America, which is demanding containment of health care costs. Major corporations have opted to self-insure. There's a trend to shift the cost of health care or the risk for health care back to the provider. Under the original Medicare legislation, Medicare paid the hospital its costs, so it was a cost arrangement. Now they're putting it on diagnostic-related groups, and industry is picking this up. So industry says, we will pay this much and you figure out how you're going to provide it for that price. So the burden will fall on the healthcare providers to offer the most cost-effective care possible while still maintaining high standards of quality. And hospitals and physicians will be looking to new joint venture partners to help syndicate or underwrite the financial risk.
Do you think it is possible to maintain the high standards that the profession would want at the same time containing the costs?
Well, that's a big debate that's going on right now, and yet there are other countries, as I've said, that have better records than we do, spending far less money. And I can't tell you where it's going to come from, but there is the feeling that that we can do a good job for no additional cost, if not for less cost. And we've done this to a certain degree already by shifting care from the hospital to an outpatient setting, shifting it to the doctor's office, shifting it to home, et cetera. The problem that we're having is that we keep bringing up new technology, which is another factor, is the accelerated use of new technology. And it's felt that only the hospitals that keep pace with the new technology are going to be the survivors. And the small ones that are either small and can't afford the technology or don't have the resources to acquire the technology are the ones that are going to be the losers and are going to end up closing. It's estimated that by 1990 there'll be approximately 700 hospitals that have closed in the country, and there are several that have closed recently in Illinois. But there is a heightened awareness of quality, as McManus pointed out, but we haven't defined quality yet. We can measure quantity, we can measure quality, but in the eyes of the patient and the consumer, quality has generally meant good food, a clean room, medication on time, and that type of thing. There's a growing trend with the Joint Commission on Accreditation of Healthcare Facilities, which is the official accrediting body of hospitals and nursing homes, to look at, to be more results-oriented in measuring quality. Not telling you what you have to do to make a patient well, but measuring how well the patient is after he or she goes home after an episode of illness, and in what period of time and what cost it can be done. And I think that's going to be the challenge. But new technology in hospitals has been additive. We create the CAT scanner, but we don't do away with the X-ray machine. Now, there are some others, however, with the lithotripter, as I just showed you that electrode. The lithotripter is practically eliminated surgery for kidney stones. And now they're coming up with a lithotripter that will do the same thing with gallstones. The question is the relative cost. There's no doubt about it that the patient is better off having his kidney stones. However, the lithotripter is probably more expensive in actual hospital costs than the surgical procedure. However, to the individual, the loss, when you take into consideration the loss of time, time away from the job, and the recuperative period, it's far less expensive than the old system of doing it surgically. And if we can do that for gallstones, we're doing many, many more things now on a non-invasive basis rather than doing them in an invasive basis by doing surgery on the patient. So that all leads to quality, but a lot of it also leads to increased costs. Coming down the road, we're going to see increased hospital failures, as I mentioned before. We're going to see pressures to merge and to consolidate. And just recently, a prominent attorney in this community said to me, said, Tony, we really only need one hospital in this town, don't we?
You know, that sounds like the beginning of a circle. And they started saying, do we need two hospitals, and decided that they would build another.
That's correct. And it's just been recently, two hospitals in Danville, Illinois have consolidated. Two hospitals in Rockford, Illinois are trying to merge. And for the first time, the Justice Department is coming in and saying, you can't do it. They filed suit against the two Rockford hospitals to keep them from merging.
Why?
Because they were going to eliminate competition, and that the remaining two hospitals in Rockford, or the new organization, the two that emerged, would have too big a share of the hospital health care market in Rockford, and therefore would be contraindicated from a restraint of trade point of view. So there are all sorts of social factors, economic factors, political factors that are involved in trying to make the healthcare system more effective, in both quality-wise and cost-wise. There are more doctors, there's more competition among doctors, there's more competition between doctors and hospitals, and it's just a fantastically changing world out there, which I'm sure will eventually all sift out into something that is practical and reasonable.
Well, what are your personal plans for the future?
Well, I enjoyed my 35 years at Decatur Memorial Hospital and all of my time in the healthcare field. There are a lot of my friends who say that I left at the right time. There are others who say that it's changing, but there are a lot of opportunities out there. I think I've reached the stage and the age where I'm happy to be doing what I'm doing. I want to remain active. As I mentioned previously, I'm the chairman of the board of an insurance company in Chicago. That doesn't take an awful lot of my time, but it keeps my interest. I'm doing some consulting for three or four firms who sell services or products to the healthcare industry. I'm playing a little golf. We plan on remaining in Decatur. We would hope that we could spend some of our winter months in a warmer climate, but we've lived in Decatur longer than we've lived anywhere else in the country, and we would like to do a little traveling along with the little work that I do.
Now, you do have children.
Yes, I have two daughters. One is an investment banker. In fact, she was just written up in City and State as being the only woman-owned investment banking firm in the country.
Good for her.
And a younger daughter is married and has two children.
Where is the banker located?
The banker is located between San Jose, California, and Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Oh.
She has an office and an apartment in Philadelphia, and a house and an office in San Jose, near San Jose, California. She's done very, very well, and she's a very capable young woman with a master's degree in business administration from Vanderbilt.
Very good. And you were telling us you have another daughter.
Yes, the younger daughter lives in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. She's married and has two children.
Very good.
And has been in the travel industry primarily.
Fine. So you will visit grandchildren?
We hope to. We don't see them as frequently as we would like to.
Good. Fine. Well, you have contributed a great deal to Decatur in your work in the hospital and other ways. And we wish you well in your future years, Mr. Perry. Thank you very much for sharing your reminiscences with us. You've been listening to the experiences of Mr. Anthony J. Perry, former administrator with the Decatur Memorial Hospital. Betty Trunell speaking for the Decatur Public Library. Very good.
Thank you.